Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 17, words we should be all familiar with. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I am the Lord your God, and I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. And therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us, and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die. I know that last verse wasn't up there probably. Second half of the Ten Commandments. I want to begin with a note, though, on the Sabbath. Now it's on. There we go. All right. I want to say something about the Sabbath right away. Something that we just don't get because we weren't the people it was first given to. Who did God give the Sabbath to at the beginning? Israelites, right? Okay. When did he give them this commandment to the Sabbath? Well, he certainly gave it to them when they were at Mount Sinai. But if you remember back in our series on Exodus, I suggested that actually is not when he gave them the commandment of the Sabbath. Even though it's not said in the text, there are all kinds of indications that it was given to them earlier. And it was given when Moses returned from the burning bush in the wilderness after being there for 40 years. He comes back to Egypt, and I want to suggest to you that he brought with him this commandment of the Sabbath, and that the Israelites began practicing it at that time, which is what ticked Pharaoh off. Remember, Pharaoh kept complaining about them being lazy and not working. He was alluding to the fact that once Moses came back and had this meeting with God, that the people of Israel were to begin showing their obedience to that God by keeping the Sabbath. I didn't pin this one on because my pen is gone for some reason. So consequently, that's all right. I'm not going to get it on, Jennifer. So consequently, we forget that the people who were given the Sabbath were what? Slaves. Slaves. Israel forgot it.
Later on, when they had such a hard time keeping the Sabbath, hold on here, guys. God gave this command to a bunch of slaves. And you know what you can say about slaves, no matter what culture they're in? There's nothing they need more than rest. They are worked to death, often literally. And as we read the text in Exodus, we know that's exactly what was going on there, right? In fact, Pharaoh said he had a plan. I'm going to work them so hard that they either die or too tired to reproduce. That was his whole plan. He wanted to cut down the numbers of the Israelites, and I'm going to do it by just beating them into the ground with hard labor. This is the people that God said, I want you to take a day off. And not only you, everybody in your house, don't you dare have your slaves work on the Sabbath. Don't you dare have the foreigner live in your land work on the Sabbath. Everybody gets a day off. And part of this should be read in the context of a people for 200-300 years didn't get a day off. They hadn't got a day off for 200-300 years. What a gift that was. The idea that the Sabbath was something that, okay, this is an onerous, difficult, laborsome, burdensome law that we have to do for God's sake is ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. The Sabbath was given to us. It's for man. It's for what we absolutely need to survive. And on top of that, God added some real perks to it. If you go back to creation, you'll see right away that the Sabbath, the first 6 days, by the way, the commandment, I don't know if you ever noticed this, but the commandment just isn't about taking a Sabbath, right? You shall work 6 days. See, in our culture, if I was going to preach the Ten Commandments, I probably should focus on the first part of that commandment. I should not have to even talk about you shall take a day off. I think we all got that one. We're getting to the point that we want to take every day off, and not for the right reasons. But the commandment actually says, you shall work 6 days. So let's talk about that work. Now, we could say that means I'm supposed to go in and, you know, do whatever job I have, and I suspect that it is connected to that. But if you went back to creation, it's pretty clear what our work is. It is our job to order and fill this world, to bring it into order and to fill it. And if you remember sermons a long time ago on Genesis, you will realize that just like it works for a husband and a wife and a husband and their children, our job is to make life flourish. Whether I'm a husband who loves my wife, my purpose is to make life flourish in her. So if I'm causing death to flourish in her, I am directly disobeying what God is telling me to be as a husband. And that comes from our job as human beings. We have been given the task of serving all of creation. He called it dominion. But then Jesus defined dominion and authority for us, which means you're to put the interest of it above yourself. You're to serve it. And you do so in such a way that you are to cause life to flourish in it. That's our job. And all jobs, in some way, should be bringing order to our environment or causing life to flourish or filling something, because we're also called, fill the earth with the glory of the Lord. And how we do that is we fill the earth with things and people that reflect His glory. And no one can reflect it better than people, because we were designed for that. That's what the work is. So what is the rest? If you are to work 6 days, and then God rested, what was God doing on day seven? He was enjoying His work. God certainly wasn't worshiping. Now, we usually think of Sabbath as all about worship. Well, it can be, but only in this sense. If you find worship a joyful thing to do, if you are rejoicing in the work of God and the work of your own hands by coming together with His people and worshiping Him, then you are in a good place on the Sabbath. But the point was not to somehow go through ritualistic worship and make sure you get all of your T's crossed and your I's dotted and make sure you take communion and get all of these things. that's just turning worship into work. The Sabbath is actually about stepping back and enjoying the life that you have had a hand in causing to flourish, whether it's with your family, with people, with your fellow Christians, whether it's with creation, whether it's in your garden. For 6 days you garden, but on day seven you eat of the garden. On day seven you enjoy the garden that you've worked so hard for. It's that simple. And that really is what the Sabbath is about. So anytime we define it in such a way that it becomes laborsome and burdensome and difficult, we're making a mistake. Now you might say, and I probably should get off this so I can get on to what I want to talk about, but you might say, but Tom, I've read in the Old Testament, I remember, they stoned a guy for picking up sticks. Yeah, they did. Because he wasn't enjoying his work. He was trying to get ahead. And by the way, just think about it. If you're in a community where your job is to collect firewood, and the whole community, you move to a new place, and the whole community takes the Sabbath off, and you get out there, and you get firewood, what are you really doing? We have a phrase for it. You're beating people to the punch. That's what you're doing. You're being what? Selfish. Don't think for a minute the man picking up sticks was not sinning, or he was only sinning. Oh, what an accident. No, it's not. There are hundreds of wood gatherers in the people of Israel. There are hundreds of them. That's how they make their living. But that guy was trying to make more than just his living. He was trying to get ahead of everybody else. And God judged him for it. That's the danger of not enjoying the rest that God gives, but instead, I think I'll spurn that rest that God gives, and I'm going to use this day to get ahead of other people so that I can have more than them. It's going to lead not just to no rest, but it's going to lead to other kinds of sinful actions in your heart that God's trying to eliminate from his people, and he doesn't desire that. Now, how all of these laws, as I mentioned, relate to the new covenant and the Christian within this covenant, I think is very different. The Sabbath today is really about the Sabbath was merely a picture of entering into Jesus' rest. We live in the Sabbath all the time now, guys, because we are no longer in the bondage of sin. We're no longer slaves. We have been freed. We have been set free from a certain thing. To do what? To be a part of what God is doing all of the time. All of the time. So honestly, when you go to work tomorrow, you should do it as a Sabbath. Because you can go to work with the attitude, Lord, I am here to work with you. I'm here to take up whatever it is you're doing to bring rest to the people around here. Because I have rest and I want to share that rest. So in the new covenant, the Sabbath looks very different. But that also doesn't mean, there's some wisdom in the old covenant's understanding of the Sabbath of you need to take a break, you need to rest. Now I want to cover the other remaining commandments all at once, and there's an easy way of doing it. Follow Jesus' lead. Just follow Jesus' lead. In Luke chapter 10, a man comes to him, and he says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? How can I gain eternal life? Now, this is not the rich young ruler. He asks the same question. This one, he's a lawyer, and just by calling him a lawyer, we probably already understand that his question was not, what's the word, genuine. He was trying to trap Jesus. What must I do? And Jesus answered with an interesting statement, not a typical evangelical statement, put your trust in me, follow me, and you'll be saved. No, he answered with a very Jewish statement. Keep the law. Keep the law. And then the question becomes, what do you mean when you say keep the law? How do you understand the law? And Jesus' answer in one version, and in the version in Luke, it's actually the man gives it back to him, and Jesus says, good answer. You got it right. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your might. That's not right. Mind. And your neighbor as yourself. And these two commands, the whole law is summed up. By the way, in those two commands, the entire Ten Commandments are summed up, right? Actually, I would say it this way. The first three commandments are, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. The fourth commandment is, you can't love your neighbor without what? Loving yourself. The fourth commandment says, guys, you need to love yourself and take a rest. You need to do this for yourself. Because if you're not taking care of yourself, if you don't have an attitude towards yourself that is a righteous attitude, a God-like attitude towards yourself, then you won't know how to treat your neighbor. Because the next six commandments are all about your neighbor, starting with your parents, who are your closest neighbors. They live in the house with you, but every one of them is about your neighbor. And it's about loving them as yourself. Which is why I wanted us to go to Leviticus 19. Because Jesus is quoting that. And as you take a look at that passage, this is where the quotation comes from. It actually comes in verse 18. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So from this verse, the Jews often asked a question. And the question they asked was a question that this man asked of Jesus. And he thought he knew the answer because every Jew knows the answer. Because the answer is right here in Leviticus 19, verse 18. Who is my neighbor? And who is he? Who is your neighbor? You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. But you shall love your neighbor. You can see in the passage, neighbor is in parallel with who? The sons of your own people, which is why the Jews already knew the answer to that question. And certainly a lawyer in Jesus' day knew the answer to it. Your neighbor was your fellow Israelite. Your fellow Israelite. That's it. That's all God is asking of you. So what does Jesus do to this question? Is Jesus changing the Levitical law? I'm going to suggest that Jesus never gets the law wrong. He always gets it right. We often misread it. We need to pay attention to how he reads it, and we'll see, oh, that's not what that meant at all. It meant something different. And this is how Jesus answered that man's question. Hopefully you guys remember this. He told the parable. He told the parable about the Good Samaritan. Now, I suspect that this particular lawyer is not a Pharisee, because Pharisees had lawyers, but so did the Sadducees. And I suspect that this lawyer was a Sadducee. And the reason why I think that is a Sadducean lawyer is going to be a Levite, possibly even a priest. And therefore, when Jesus tells the story, he's really hitting target, dead aim, right at the bullseye. So there was this man that went down from Jerusalem, and he was caught on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho by robbers, and he was beaten to an inch of his life and was thrown into the ditch, and all of his stuff was taken. Then came down the road a priest. You know, somebody like you. Somebody just like you. And as that priest came down the road, he saw the man in the ditch, and what did he do? He crossed over to the other side of the road and ignored him and walked on by. In case the man didn't get the point, the next guy who comes down is a Levite. He might have said, well, I'm not a priest, I'm actually a lawyer. Lawyers are better than priests. In what world? Actually, in our world at this point sometimes. But now it's just a Levite. He can't escape that designation. And the Levite does the same thing. And then a Samaritan comes down the road and sees the man and picks him up, puts him on his donkey, cares for him, takes him to an inn, goes, you want to talk about the extra mile, goes way beyond anything any Jew would ever dream of doing for another, even fellow Israelite in this situation. So that man has in his mind, the answer to my question is, my fellow Israelite. Jesus' response to him is, well, if your fellow Israelite's your neighbor, you're still doing a pretty miserable job. because you're walking by your fellow Israelite all the time. But that's not really the problem. The problem is you're asking the wrong question. You ask the wrong question of a text and you'll get the wrong answer. The question you're asking is, who is my neighbor? The very nature of that question is being asked to limit who your neighbor is. It's to find a way out of the command, and you're already in trouble. Jesus makes the point, it is not about asking the question, who is my neighbor? It's about asking the question, who can I be a neighbor to? That's the question you should be asking. Who can I be a neighbor to? And the answer to that question is also given in Leviticus 19. Let's go back. Verse 9. I want you to see all the people you can be a neighbor to. Because the second set of commandments there, 6 through 10, is all about being a neighbor to somebody and how you can be a good neighbor. That's what it's about. How you can be a good neighbor. And who you should be a neighbor to, you will find in this passage as well, but that's not the question you should be asking. You should be asking, how can I be neighborly? How can I be a neighbor to somebody? And here we see it. When you reap the harvests of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. In other words, when you work, and you do so to make a profit, whether you sell tires or you're a farmer, it doesn't matter. If you work in such a way that you glean all of the profits of your work, you are not neighborly. You're not neighborly. You can't just apply this to farmers. Farmers, leave the edges of your field. Why? So that people that don't have anything can come and pick those things up. It's a way for them to survive, but it's also a way for you to remember something. God is the one who gave you this harvest. And he didn't give it to you to be selfish. He didn't give you this wealth, this harvest, just so you could hoard it for yourself and your family. He gave it to you to be generous. So if you need to be neighborly, you've got to leave the edges of your field. You know, one of my favorite things about living in Idaho is this time of year. If you really wanted to and you paid attention, you would never have to buy a potato the rest of the year. I can still remember right outside of Blackfoot, there was an exit. It was almost inevitable. It was right before you got to Blackfoot, actually. The trucks would be coming out of the potato fields and they'd swing that corner. Oh, love that corner. Hundreds and hundreds of potatoes fell out of those trucks. All you had to do is kind of sit there and wait. And then you'd grab a bag and you'd pick up potatoes. You could have 300 pounds of potatoes and nothing flat. And if you have a good seller, you got potatoes for the year. And you never had to pay for them. Well, that's kind of what God is saying. Hey, with your harvest, let them fall out. Take the corner fast. Take the corner. Let them fall out of the truck. Because there's a lot of people who need potatoes. And they will swoop in here and grab those, especially in southeast Idaho. In fact, you know who the people who need the potatoes the most? The very people harvesting them. Because they're all immigrant workers from Mexico. And they have hardly anything. But you better let them eat of your field. Because that's exactly what this passage is talking about. Leave the edges. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather fallen grapes of your vineyard. You know how many ways you could apply this? Let's say I am an insurance agent in Anaconda. It is not my job to get out there and get every last client for myself. That's like a farmer who strips his vineyard bare. Every last grape I'm going to gather into my barn. Hold on. Don't you think you can leave a few grapes out there on the vine for other people? Think of how you could apply that in so many different jobs. So often we approach our jobs, if I'm good at this job, and by the way, this is the way the world defines it, but we're not of the world. This is not how Jesus defines it. Quit acting like the world. I'm going to get out there and I'm going to get every last customer. I'm going to have the hardware store where everybody comes to. and I'm going to put all the rest of them out of business. That's not Christian. That's not how we operate businesses. That's not how we operate farms. And that's not how we operate our lives, because it requires a certain kind of mentality. And basically, the mentality is this: I don't care about my neighbor. I care about myself. And I am going to keep everything to myself. That's not being a good neighbor. And you will disobey every one of those commands eventually when you have that attitude about your stuff. You say, well, I won't. I'll at least honor my father and mother. Really? Why does then Jesus have to tell a story about Jews in his day who make things, quote, Corban, dedicated to the temple, because they wanted to keep their stuff and did not want to even share their stuff with their own fathers, their own families? Because once you become selfish and you feed that selfishness, guys, it'll eventually even affect your own family. You'll be selfish with them. You might start off being very generous with your family, but nobody else. But trust me, you feed that selfishness and it's only a matter of time where you're not even sharing with your family. And you'll violate that command as well. But we're not done here. Look at all of our neighbors in this passage. Well, here's our neighbor. They finally have been mentioned. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. Because the poor and the sojourner are your neighbor. Who can I be neighborly to? You can be neighborly to the poor and the sojourner. Let's go on. You shall not steal. You shall not deal falsely. Oh, these sound like the Ten Commandments. You shall not lie to one another. Why is that? Because they're your neighbors. You're lying to your neighbor. You're stealing from your neighbor. You're dealing falsely with your neighbor. You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. By the way, I think this is interesting. I also think it makes my point. That when I lie to somebody, my neighbor, when I deal with them falsely, I am in fact profaning the name of God, because the name of God is upon me. I call myself a Christian in my case, but in the Jews' case, they call themselves the people of Yahweh. And then they treat each other that way. They're profaning the name of Yahweh. And that's why that is here at this point. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. It's talking, so we know he's still talking about neighbors here. Quit stealing and lying and bearing false witness against your neighbor. You cannot rob your neighbor. That is not how to act in a neighborly way. And then he gives some examples. We're going to have some more examples of who our neighbors are. And some of us aren't going to like them. And I guarantee you that lawyer probably didn't like them. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. The reason for that was the same reason we have it in the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. The worker, the average worker in the ancient world, spanning thousands of years, their food came from that day's work. So if you withheld their wages for a while, you are putting them in a bind. They cannot eat. In fact, this kind of behavior is still happening in Asia today. This happens in China all the time to keep people virtual prisoners. They withhold wages for months until the person cannot afford. There's no way they can ever leave the job because they won't get paid. And God has some strong words, not just in the Old Testament. He says it in James as well. If you're a Christian and you're an employer, your hired worker is your neighbor. You better love them as yourself. And how do you love them as yourself? You pay them when it's due. And in the ancient world, it was due that day. You pay them that day. You don't even hold back, because you are a neighbor and he is your neighbor. And you are to love your neighbor as yourself. So consequently, who is my neighbor? Well, the poor, the sojourner, the hired worker. They're all my neighbors. And he's not done. You shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. This is an interesting couple of neighbors. Deaf and blind people are your neighbors. We might use the phrase, disabled people are your neighbors. Being where I come from and what I have done most of my life, the mentally ill are your neighbors. I bring them up specifically, and here's why. I have never known a group of people who have experienced the parable of the Good Samaritan more than they have. And what I mean by that is, I've never seen a group of people where people literally cross the street to avoid them all of the time. Literally. That's not being neighborly. You're not loving them as yourself. Do you want to be avoided? Do you want people to avoid you in your time of need? I don't think so. And here he tells us, oh, the blind and the deaf, you don't curse them. This is interesting because they did curse them. At this point in the game, I don't know if they did curse them, but later on in Israel's history, they would. Because the prophet spoke of the fact that blindness and lameness was a plague upon Israel because of their spiritual condition. And Israelites made a huge mistake. They then began believing that a person became blind or lame because of the sin that they had committed or the sin of their family. Now, they were closer with the answer, the sin of their family, but they're still wrong. And we know this from John chapter 9. This comes up. There's a blind man there. Who sinned? He or his parents? Okay. And Jesus' answer was neither. Neither sinned. It was just for the glory of God to be revealed in this person's life. Now, they could be blind because of their sin. That also happens in Jesus' day where the person has sinned. And Jesus, in fact, it's in John 5. Jesus heals him and says, now go and sin no more. Something worse is going to happen to you. So that could have been a correct answer. It just isn't always. But you know the answer that they never thought of? They never really understood what was going on in the prophets? The reason why that man is blind is to remind me that I am spiritually blind. Because that was also going on. That God plagued Israel with blind people and deaf people. They had an inordinate number of blind and deaf people. And for this reason, because they were symbols and reminders of the problem in the hearts of all Israelites. So just think of that story where these Jews are standing in judgment of this blind man. Oh, he's cursed by God. No, he's not. He's a reminder that you are cursed by God. That's what he is. His presence in your community is merely a reminder that you are now presently, which they were, living under the curse of God, the wrath of God, because of their idolatry all the way back to the Babylonian exile. And they had not yet been brought back into the presence of God. That's what Jesus was there to do. So those blind and deaf people that they were cursing, because, oh, God must hate them. He doesn't even let them into the temple. That is correct, because they have something that's connected with death. Blindness and death was deafness was a reminder of death, that our bodies are failing. So they weren't allowed into the temple, which is interesting. I've always thought that they sat at the gate of the temple because that's where the traffic was and they were beggars. Always sit in a place where there's a lot of traffic if you're going to beg. That might not be doing them justice. Remember the man who sat at the gate of Beautiful? Right outside the temple. He may have been sitting at that gate because that's as close as he could get to the presence of God, and he was going to get as close as he could get. And don't think for a minute that God didn't look down there and see the people in the temple who, they just took it for granted that they could go into the temple, and they weren't really even in there because they were interested in drawing near to God. And he saw the man at the gate and said, now that man has a heart for me. He can't go into the temple, but he hangs out right there at the door because he wants to be as close to me as he possibly can. Someday I'm sending somebody to heal that guy. And what happens when they heal that guy? Is it an accident, you think? What does he do? He runs into the temple, not walks. It says he runs. Jumping and hollering praise to God. As soon as he could, he got even closer to God. Shouldn't that be us? And Israel cursed these people. And Leviticus's point is, are you looking for these people to be neighborly for? You should be looking for disabled people to be their neighbor, to take care of them. Pretty soon it starts to become clear that maybe Jesus understood this passage better than the Jews did. Verse 15, you shall do no injustice in court. And I love this one because this one catches you off guard. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. Believe it or not, part of loving your neighbor as yourself, sometimes it means showing mercy, absolutely. But sometimes your neighbor needs justice. You're doing them no favor by allowing them to continually act wrongly. You can actually be loving your neighbor as yourself by standing up for what is right with your neighbor. Now, what's interesting here is when you do it, make sure you do it this way. Don't show partiality. In other words, don't treat the poor person one way and the rich person another way. And this can go either way, can it? In the ancient culture, I suspect the problem was they treated rich people well and they treated poor people badly. But in God, in his holy wisdom, knew that would not always be the case. He knew that there's going to be cultures, there's going to be places, there's going to be times when it's the other way around. When if a poor person does this, I'm going to treat them this way, but if a wealthy person does this, I'm going to treat them worse. I can think of my, you know, the illustration that comes to my mind is our friend Mike Powell once shot a moose. Mary, I think, shared it some. I can't remember you telling somebody about it recently. But he shot a moose by accident. It was a yearling, and it was running in a herd of elk. And granted, I'm sorry, Mike, but it's still a dumb thing to do. There's lots of good explanations there, but you're still shooting a moose. Those ears should have been a dead giveaway. But he shot a moose, and he realized it right away, and he turned himself in right away. He called the game warden. They came out, and he turned himself in, and he went to court. And he was there in court with another man, a poor man, a man in destitute, who had poached a moose. Both of them committed the same crime. He did it intentionally. He poached the moose because he needed to feed his family. Well, that's a pretty good reason. But he did it intentionally. He did not report himself. He got caught. Okay, so you got two different people. Mike got a $2,000 fine. The poor man got the moose. They gave him the moose and no fine. Now, that's not justice. I understand how the judge was thinking. That's not impartial. To love your neighbor often means to show mercy to them. But show mercy impartially. Don't just show mercy to the people you like and not mercy to the people you dislike. Don't show mercy to the rich person but not to the poor person. Don't show mercy to the person who looks like me and no mercy to the person who doesn't look like me. You show it impartially. And at times, you need to show justice impartially because mercy is not working. They're not responding to mercy. And if you love them, just like if you love your children, you're going to discipline them. You're going to give them justice. I give my kids an awful lot of mercy, but if they never got justice, I would have some pretty horrible children. And if you love your kids, at some point you got to give them justice. And if you love your neighbor, you have to give them justice. And we're almost done now. You shall not go, by the way, it calls them, but in righteousness you shall what? Judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand up against the life of your neighbor. Do not slander your neighbor. Don't speak against him. And in this case, I think the suggestion is you're accusing your neighbor of something that could get him killed. That seems pretty obvious. That's not very neighborly. You shall not, and what do you know? Jesus reads the Bible pretty well. You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly, and I know different versions say something different here, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. Do you think that may have been what Jesus was getting at when he said, when you hate your brother in your heart, you might as well have committed murder? In other words, if you just allow that hatred to fester, this is what it's going to ultimately lead to. So it is not a loving thing to do to hate your neighbor. You need to reason with them. It doesn't do them any good to hate them. Reason with them. And then finally, he says, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. Yeah, your own people are also included in neighbors, but so are an awful lot of other people. And if you think the stranger or the native or the foreigner, well, you're thinking, well, yeah, but the blind and deaf guy, they are Jews. And the hired worker, they are Jews. Although in Israel, the hired worker often wasn't a Jew. So he doesn't make that distinction. You could go all through all of this and you could try to argue. And that sojourner at the beginning, he's only mentioned briefly. Is he really my neighbor? Do I really need to teach those illegal aliens and those legal aliens like neighbors? Do I really need to do that? Well, all you have to do is go down a little farther in Leviticus 19, and unfortunately, you're going to find out you do. And it isn't unfortunate, because if we have the love of Christ in us, then this is something that should be a joy for us, to be neighborly to all that God has called us to, be neighborly to. He says in verse 33, by the way, verse 32 says, be neighborly to the gray head, honor the face of an old man. I love you. I love you, Gail. And when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. Oops, I guess we can't dismiss them. He just defined him as a neighbor. You shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Wow. How do I keep the Ten Commandments? Be a good neighbor. Love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and be a good neighbor. And you'll keep the Ten Commandments. In fact, you'll keep the whole law. You'll keep the whole law. Because all of those things are about looking for people to be neighborly to. Who can I love as myself? Isn't that what God did? Did God just look in a particular place for who he could love through his son, Jesus Christ? Or did he look everywhere? Was God looking in every corner, picking up every rock, trying to find another person that he could love and that would receive his love? Or did he just direct his love towards the Jews? One of the reasons why we should be looking everywhere for neighbors is because we are to be reflecting the image of God to this world, and this is how God operates. He is always looking for somebody to love, somebody to share his love with, let them know his son died for them, calling them to himself, come to Jesus, come to me. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. He's constantly out there looking for neighbors to call to himself. And so should we be. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this reminder from Leviticus of what you were getting at in Exodus 20. And I pray that as we live our lives in our community, in our families, which sometimes can be the hardest place to apply this, in our nation, in our world, that we are constantly looking for people to share the love that you shared with us with them, and to love people as we love ourselves. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.